I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
So welcome to On the Continent, your one-stop shop for all things European football. I'm Dotson Adebayo.
I'm Andy Brassel.
And I'm Nikki Bandini.
On today's show, we look ahead to the return of the Bundesliga and Serie A. Can Juventus and Bayern Munich be challenged? We also look at the horrible scenes in PSG's against Marseille from Ligue 1. And we're back with some games of the week. A lot to talk about from Serie A, Nikki. I do know that. And you've got a few ideas of where we're going to go with it. Just on the issue of Juventus, first of all, they're the team to beat. Can they be beaten?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's... The thing is, I do feel a bit like I'm repeating myself from 12 months ago. Because a year ago it was, hey, Maurizio Sarri is manager. Is Sarri capable of leading this team where it needs to go? A manager who hasn't ever led a team of this... Well, that's not true. He'd led Chelsea at that point, but who hasn't ever won a major domestic title, who hasn't... sort of characterised himself as a front runner who's anti-establishment. Can he be the person to lead Juventus to a title? And he did. It was, in fact, I would say the least impressive of all Juventus' titles in this run of 9 consecutive. So there was some truth in it. But yes, Juventus still got to the end and got there. This season, it's the same question being asked for different reasons. This team, this juggernaut, this force that we expect to sweep all before it in Italy. And the only real question should be, are they going to win in Europe? That isn't the question, because they've appointed someone who has literally never managed a professional football team before. Someone who was supposed to have a bit of time to learn the profession in the under-23 team in a job that he was appointed for literally 9 days before he gets the main job. So it is about Juventus. It's going to be about Juventus because they are the richest club in Italy. They're the team that's won nine times in a row, the team that has this expectation of winning, that has the biggest wage budget. And I think it's genuinely fascinating. I think it's fascinating to ask ourselves, do we believe that Andrea Pirlo, who clearly knows plenty about football, who was one of the finest midfielders of a generation, maybe ever, who I believe certainly can have that rapport like Zinedine Zidane did at Madrid with the players because he played recently, because he understands what it means to win at the highest level, because frankly, players will listen to him. But that doesn't still mean that we know he can be a manager. We just don't. So I think it sort of starts there this season in Italy, the conversation for sure.
There are a few angles to this, really, aren't there, Nicky? Because I guess one of them would be Juventus, a club that are known for meticulous planning, a club that are known for building their success off the back of a really solid business model. Has the arrival of Cristiano Ronaldo, who has done nothing wrong, he's done everything that has been expected of him on the field, has the arrival of Cristiano Ronaldo led them to this point because it skewed their timeline so much that now the timeline is not a collective timeline, it's a megastar timeline?
I think that's exactly it. And I think that this is, I mean, yeah, it again, I feel like I'm just repeating the word fascinating, but it is to me. I think that it's inescapable, this feeling that Juventus have looked at what happened at Madrid, where Zidane gets the job, where Zidane elevates Ronaldo again, because Zidane is maybe one of the very, very few people in the world who can look at Ronaldo and say, hey, you need to rest. We're going to prioritize the big games. We're going to let you do the best. Give us everything you've got when we need it most, rather than against, I don't know, Getafe in my head, but those other teams I should name in the league before them. And he'll listen because he knows that you're you and you've done this. Except Zidane had 2 seasons coaching Madrid's B team, the Castilla team, which Pirlo doesn't have. So it isn't the same. But I feel like that is the narrative that has played into this. I think that if it wasn't for Ronaldo, perhaps it could have been a different direction. Perhaps you would have said, okay, Pirlo, take that time in the youth team. But the time frame for Ronaldo is unknown. Right. Mm. I mean, he's played very well the last 2 seasons. And I think that's not in doubt. No one should question that Ronaldo has contributed at Juventus. But he has, in the way that he does, made the team and the club orbit around him. That everything is about Ronaldo. And yes, they want to win the Champions League. And that's still the biggest priority. But I have questions about, and these questions can't be answered until we see them play, about whether or not this is going to let them maintain that domestic hegemony as well. I mean, it's worth saying that for all that Ronaldo has contributed, and I don't think you blame him for these failures, Juventus haven't just sort of not gone back to their Champions League latter stages to the final in the last couple of years. They've lost to Ajax and Lyon, which with the greatest sort of already respect. Sounds patronising as soon as I say that, doesn't it? It sounds awful.
Don't show them any respect. I don't want your respect.
But it's not about what they were, because Ajax were brilliant that season. They were brilliant. They were. But there is that still matters, is what I'm trying to say. But Juventus still look at those results and say, well, these aren't the clubs we're supposed to lose to. If we're going to lose in Europe and we lose to PSG, Manchester City, Real Madrid, okay, we can sort of say, well, our place in this hierarchy of superclubs, because that is how Juventus view themselves. It's as much as anything about how Juventus view themselves.
Yeah, because you're a hostage to fortune to a certain degree in the Champions League, in that not always the best team wins it. In fact, quite as Miguel was saying last week, quite often the best team doesn't win it. Mm. But I think you can. It's got to be about the manner as much as the final result. But if we're going back to Serie A for a second, Dotton, as a relative neutral, how important is it, you think, that for the image of Serie A, that a team that's not Juventus wins it?
Well, let me say, first of all, I'm from the generation that where Juventus was Juventus. And like Nicky says, they are a juggernaut. So,
who were polished off by Ajax.
And it's a really good question, because for my generation, okay, Juventus have always been there. They've got a legacy there. But so have Inter. Been there. So have AC Milan been there. So have Sampdoria been there? Napoli have been there. Other teams have been there. Now it just seems like we're waiting at the beginning of the season for Juventus to lift the cup and to lift the title as well. And that doesn't make sense to me. And I wonder, actually, the real question is, Nikki, whether with the lack of, not competition, but with the lack of an equal rival, has Juventus gone downwards football-wise or not?
So I want to say really quickly, because I feel like I'm going to get slaughtered for what I said about Ajax and Lyon. It's not about how I perceive those clubs. It is about how Juventus perceives itself, which is this juggernaut conversation. It is about Andrea Agnelli, who goes and stands up in front of the world and says, should we really have Atalantas in the Champions League? Because that is how this club frames itself. This club frames itself as part of a European elite, and that's where it belongs. And I think that actually Agnelli has also said in those sorts of conversations many times, he wants there to be the other Italian super clubs being super again. He wants to see Milan being brilliant. He wants the Inter being brilliant. Of course, he wants to see his club ahead of them, but he wants them to be there. And I think what's interesting about this season for me, well, there's 100 things I find interesting about the season. I do think those two Milan clubs, who are structurally the teams that should be competing with Juventus over time. In any given season, anything can happen, but those two teams are, they have the fan base, not just nationally, but internationally. They have the sort of set up as a club to do it. There are signs that they could be there. I mean, Inter were already 1 point behind last season. Of course, the last couple of games, Juventus already had it sewn up. But still, Milan are also coming back in an interesting way. Post-lockdown, they had the most, they were top of the table post-lockdown in Italy. They have a really, really interesting young midfield there now with Ismail Benacer and Franck Kessier, who both came on leaps and bounds under Stefano Pioli last season. Now you add in Sandro Tonali, who is one of the most intriguing young Italian midfield prospects going. I think he has some rough edges that need to get shined off. But I think also not just sort of individually a fascinating talent, but I think he kind of does something different to those other two, which makes it a really fascinating mesh. I think there are reasons to think that those things are coming up. Are they ready to challenge Juventus? I mean, in the end, it requires Juventus to slip. And that was the same as last season. Juventus did slip and Inter couldn't quite do it. But you need another season like that from Juventus to make it possible, because a few seasons ago, Juventus were winning with 100 points. You know, it's hard to overtake someone who's got 100 points. Napoli got 91, still didn't win the league. I've realised I still haven't actually answered your question.
No, no.
I only just realised I've gone way off what your question was. I understand where people come from with this idea that you can't win the Champions League if you're dominating domestically this easily. Bayern Munich have won how many titles in a row now?
Yeah, they're going for their ninth.
Right.
They're going for their ninth. If you look
at
before last season, Barcelona were 8 out of 11, we talked about it last week, didn't we? The fact that you consider it to be an equal rivalry between Real Madrid and Barcelona has not been domestically over the last couple of years. But before we go on to Pirlo versus Conte, which is going to be really interesting, I think, because I think for most of us, we would say Inter are the best place. In fact, maybe Conte's sort of put some of his, let's describe them as what they are, feelings of hatred towards the Inter board to one side, because maybe he thinks this is our chance. This is our chance to take the Scudetto, or my chance to take the Scudetto off Juventus, as I suspect he's thinking of it. The thing that's interested me most about what we don't know about Pirlo as a coach is most of it. Because no one can know anything really about Pirlo, especially a first team coach. But, you know, the thing that gives Pirlo room and space is the aesthetics. You know, what he's seen to represent as a player, as a football thinker, as a football philosopher, his vision of the game. What's been really interesting to me, in his first couple of press conferences, he said, I want to tap into the old Juventus DNA. It's got to be about hard graft. It's got to be about organisation. It's got to be about being difficult to beat. And that takes us right back to Conte, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. That's, if that is what he thinks the Juventus DNA is, it's because he was there under Conte when, you know, Pirlo's career was still mostly at Milan. He had this great, I mean, he was transformative for that team, frankly, period at Juventus. But yes, that was the Conte Juventus. And that is very much the embodiment of Juventus that that Conte was as a player as well. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how many different ways to say it. I'm fascinated to see what this team looks like on the pitch, because that is the message he's sold. We're going to be a team that is a possession team, and we are going to basically, if we lose the ball, the ambition is win it back as quickly as you can. So I'm expecting high tempo, pressing, aggression.
How does Ronaldo fit into that?
Well, I mean, what's funny is it's not exactly how you picture Pirlo as a player, is it?
No, it's not.
But yeah, it's a great question how Ronaldo fits into it. And the dynamic that I'm perhaps most sort of interested to see how it shakes out just between individual players is Dejan Kulusevski, who I think covered the third most ground of any player in Serie A last season.
Oh, wow.
You're bringing in like a young 20, is he actually 20 or is he tiny bit over 20? 20-odd player who potentially could be a foil to Ronaldo up front and could contribute some of that in theory. But again, I won't know what this team looks like until we see it this weekend.
Seems like the DNA of Juventus is still up for grabs, though. Mm. Particularly when you bring in a legend like Pirlo is to coach, that actually his vision of the DNA might be very different from the actual DNA, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. Well, it's funny when you talk about Juventus DNA, my mind just immediately goes to a couple of things. One is this sort of slogan that they've lived by the last few seasons, which is hashtag fino alla fine, which means until the end. And I think that has been what I would sort of see as the recent embodiment of Juventus, because there have been times when you've thought, oh, maybe they're not going to do it this season, but they always come up with a goal at the end. They always do that. So they have that. The other thing is just the old Giampiero Buonaperti line, which was winning's not important, it's the only thing that counts. That's always been the club's DNA.
That's not bad. That's not always a bad
been,
line.
It's always been the club's DNA. It doesn't matter.
That's like a Bill Shankly quote,
there,
isn't
as
it?
Long as it is. It's very Bill Shankly. In fact, the first, there was a Bill Shankly quote, which I can't remember now. And I was like, wasn't that a Buonaperti quote? This happened like really recently. But to think there's any sort of identity here beyond one that could also be embodied by the old Oakland Raiders owner, Al Davis, just win, baby. That's Juventus to me. Juventus is just win, and they do.
Yeah, a couple of other stories from Italy as well. You want to talk about Roma have new owners. What's new?
So far, not a lot. But I think that's a certain degree of everyone needs to be patient. They haven't come in and immediately tipped all these billions that the Friedkin family have into the project yet. They have sort of preached a fairly sensible line of, look, we still have to balance the books and we still have to focus first and foremost on the stadium project and bring in those revenues that can allow the club to grow sustainably. It sort of, in the immediate term, what seems to be happening is loss before gains, because one thing, simply unfortunate circumstance, Nicolò Zaniolo, who's been so brilliant when he's been on the pitch the last season, but second cruciate ligament tear suffered while away on international duty is just a hammer blow to that team, in my opinion. And then Edin Dzeko is close to a move to Juventus. Yeah. Which would leave obviously a pretty big void. Now the club is in talks to try and sign Arkadiusz Milik. They're also looking at some other young players. Milik isn't young, but they're looking at some younger players like Kumbula. It could be an interesting team, but too early to say.
How old is Dzeko now? He must be getting
34, I want to say. I'm terrible on footballer ages. I mean,
it's impressive, though. It's impressive. Still playing top flight football at the age of 34.
Great addition to that pressing style that Pirlo is looking for. It's really interesting contradiction, isn't it? That idea of like we're gonna play in this sort of, you know, like a sort of butcher's dog chasing scraps kind of way with a load of old guys up front, because of course they've been looking at Luis Suarez as well, who still has it.
Oh, of course he
but
has.
But he doesn't have all of it. No. He doesn't have the athletic part of it anymore, does he?
No. I mean, I don't think Suarez is going to happen at this point. There's been a whole saga with that because he was trying to sort out his Italian citizenship to make things easier and had language exams booked and everything. But what I'm hearing is that deal seems to have gone on the back burner now.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if Luis Suarez sorts out his Italian citizenship. I think he might be able to get Ghanaian citizenship after the World Cup in 2010. I'm just saying, if he wants it.
He's going to get the flick in, and Muslera, oh, goal, cleared on the line, and cleared on the line a second. The referee's assistant is flagging. What a dramatic thing. There's a red card coming out as well. Well, there had to be drama right at the end here. And the red card is shown. Suarez is sent off.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Let's move on to talk about Bayern Munich now, who are in many ways, I suppose, the Juventus of Germany, aren't they?
They're that likable, yes. Yeah. I think it's fair
to
say.
Well, they win everything is a point, wasn't it?
They do, and I think it's a good point, Dotton, because just like Juventus going for 10 in a row, Bayern are going for 9 in a row. And really, I think when you're looking at the whole title picture in the Bundesliga, you have to look at a way that Bayern can kind of sabotage themselves. Going back to what you were saying, Nicky, really about Juventus. And it's hard to see that at the moment because I think it's pretty clear that they're not only the Champions League holders. Unlike a lot of Champions League holders, I think it's fair to say they are the best team in Europe. The questions for them...
What makes them the best? Sorry to cut you. What makes them the best team in Europe, do you think? Apart from winning everything, but what makes them the best?
I think it's how everything's gone under Hansi Flick has been extraordinary, really. A coach who not just connects with the players on an emotional level, but is tactically astute. And I think it's quite unusual to get both of those. And you're not expecting to get both of those from someone who's got, you know, really no head coach experience at a top club before is extraordinary, but improved and inspired backup appointment by the club. And also, I think what's so frightening about Bayern is when you look at, apart from say, Neuer, Lewandowski, maybe to a lesser extent, Jerome Boateng. It's a young team that you expect to get better and better and better. It screams dynasty. But as I was saying in my Guardian piece earlier this week, if you're looking for that act of self-sabotage, good old Ole Hernes comes in. And, you know, he is only the honorary president now, having stepped down as actual active club president a little while ago. But it turns out, even though he is, you know, kind of still inside the Bayern tent, he's definitely the guy you want inside the tent pissing out rather than outside the tent pissing in. And the problem is, he's never going to be able to stop himself chatting to TV and radio. And they're in this position at the moment, this very delicate position with, well, it has been with Thiago Alcantara and David Alaba. Now, with Thiago, his move to Liverpool, by the time you're listening to this, I suspect will have already happened. They're very, very close.
Sure about that?
No, I said, I suspect.
Yes.
That's why I said, I suspect. But I think that is something, that is a loss that Karl-Heinz Rummenigge can live with. He would have liked him to stay, but he said, well, look, he's a foreign player with a year left on his contract. It's going to be his last big contract. I understand. He wants to try something else. That's maybe not all of what he thinks, but it's the diplomatic way of putting it. And it's the reasonable way of thinking about it. And it's the path of least resistance. Also, you have to bear in mind, as brilliant as Thiago was in the Champions League final, if Benjamin Pavard is fully fit, he doesn't play. Pavard plays at right back, and Joshua Kimmich, who's, you could argue, the real leader of the team, plays in the centre alongside Leon Goretzka. The impressively muscled Leon Goretzka, as I have to call him, just like you have to call niece, Patrick Vieira's niece, you have to call him the newly muscled Leon Goretzka or whatever. Anyway, so Thiago looks like it's fine. The problem is David Alaba. The problem's not Alaba himself.
That's a big problem, mate. That's a huge problem.
Yeah, it's a huge problem, as you say, because he's into his last year of contract. Not he's got 1 year of contract left, but bear in mind, we're in September because of the weird time synchronicity of things at the moment. And his contract is going to be up on June 30th next year. Now, Alaba is hugely important to them, not just on the pitch. And on the pitch, he's come off a career season where he's been unbelievable at centre-back. He's added value to the team on the pitch in that sense, and also in the sense that he's been next to Alphonso Davies, really on-pitch coaching him into one of the best left-backs and probably future best left-back in the world. And it's one of the things, you know, all the things you notice when there's no crowd noise. And that was certainly the case for the first couple of Bundesliga games. The first thing we notice, you notice who the talkers are in the team. David Alaba never shuts up. And that is extremely valuable, not just to Davies, but to the whole of the team. He's loved in the changing room. He's a model pro. He's also got Pini Zahavi as his agent.
It's a problem.
Well, it's a problem for Bayern because they don't really like being told. And that's an issue. Now, of course, Uli Hoeneß did this now infamous interview on Sport 1, a television station in Germany last weekend, saying, calling Zahavi a greedy piranha, which has issues. In my view, has issues in that it could be considered a little anti-Semitic as well, which is far from ideal. And I think it wouldn't kill Uli Hoeneß to apologise for something for once, if it could be construed in that way. Also, the fact is that Bayern are treading on eggshells. They know they can't afford to lose this guy. And they've gone there before with, I know Toni Kroos has been mentioned, a player who they would have liked to keep on but didn't want to pay the full whack. With Alaba, I don't see how it can be a choice. He's so valuable in so many ways. And as, you know, a house player as well, someone who's come through at Bayern, someone who's a Mr. Bayern, they can't afford to let him go. They need to seal this up. And I tell you what, A, is stressing out Hansi Flick. He's made that pretty clear in public. He's tried to sidestep it and say, well, it's not really my business. Hopefully he stays, et cetera, et cetera. But it's got to be something on the mind of Hansi Flick. And really, that could just do for once with Uli Hoeneß keeping his mouth shut about this. That would be really nice.
Is he likely to, Nicky? You know, Uli Hoeneß, he can't stop having a proper Mesut Ozil every opportunity he gets, amongst other things.
I don't think so. I think if you wanted him to be... I was just sort of... Because in a sense, he's like... he's taken on the role of like the awkward uncle at a family gathering or
is it a bit Stadler and Waldorf, do we think?
Yeah.
Or Rummenigge will come upstairs to join him in a bit in the little balcony.
And so I was sort of thinking, like, how do you sort of stop the awkward uncle from ruining everything at your party? And it's not always easy. The best thing is possibly to distract them, give them something else to do, which is sort of, I suppose, you know, it's what you said before, beautifully put about inside the tent and outside the tent. You know, you give him a job because you think that might help, I think, rather than having him be outside and just sort of starting fires. Maybe you think you can sort of direct him a bit, but it doesn't feel like that's happened.
He's always been forthright, but he's just been so much more combustible. You know, when people get to a certain point of age and they just don't care anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like, that's exactly the sort of relative that I'm imagining. And they they don't care. You're not going to stop them that way. And I actually think in certain situations, that's probably an asset to you as a club. Mm. Because frankly, there are times when you might not want to say something because diplomatically it looks bad, but you can let Uli Hoeneß say it and go, nothing we could do. It's just
yes. I can see that.
But But I, as you say, this is, you know, there's also a fine line. And at the moment, he's sort of across it, basically.
On the other hand, Dotton, they have added Leroy Sané, which just seems absolutely brutal when you think of the quality, the power they've got at their disposal already, and he should be totally refreshed. I mean, we're looking at a situation where basically we've got to worry a little bit, I think, about the quality of football going forward, because no players all over Europe have really had a proper pre-season. Now, someone coming off a long-term injury is an exception to that. They've done, on the contrary, like, a really, really, really long pre-season. He's been doing a pre-season for, what, the best part of a year, I suppose. So if Sané were to take the team by the horns, that wouldn't really surprise me this much. I think the interesting thing is, in this title race, if it's going to be a title race, you can only really imagine it being between Bayern and Dortmund, because I think we saw what Leipzig did in the Champions League, and it feels to me that the model has a bit of a ceiling, you know, that they weren't really prepared for getting that far in the Champions League. They're not really prepared to build on it because they want to do the same thing that they've always done. They want to buy players who are 20, 21, 22, and then sell them on for a fortune later on. You know, they're not going to bring in experienced guys who are in their late 20s for like 40, 50 million. It's just not going to happen, even if they do have the money. I think as well, you look at Leverkusen, who I still think could be pretty good. They've got Patrick Schick, who was on loan at Leipzig and was very, very good. Obviously, Nicky knows very well from Italy. He had a great season for most of last season when he started to get his rhythm. I think he's helpful for Leverkusen, but at the end of it, they've still lost Kai Havertz, who's their main guy. Borussia Mönchengladbach, I think you've got to look at the balance of them building. And they've not lost any major players, but that they are playing Champions League. And you look at the Champions League schedule, the way it's been condensed, this is going to be really hard on players all over the place, even for big clubs, because it's almost Champions League every week between mid-October and Christmas, which is going to be tough. So really, it does come down to Bayern and Dortmund. Now, the question with Dortmund is, what is acceptable? Because no one's going to come out and say, right, we have to win the league this year. But they can't really get away with finishing below the second. They've got a coach in the last year of his contract in Lucien Favre, who I think would have got binned if they felt there was an upgrade out there. I don't think they think there is a realistic upgrade out there at the moment. But there's been a sense that maybe he's holding the team back a little bit. Also, they've got this image of being these wonderful, bright young things because of Haaland, Sancho, still there. Gio Reyna, Jude Bellingham, who became the youngest player, as we were saying on the Ramble earlier this week, the youngest player in Dortmund's history to score for them in 17 years and 77 days.
Can we talk about what a great name Jude Bellingham is? That's a leading man name. Like, don't you? Like, that should be like a movie star name. Jude Bellingham.
It could be.
Works I love
me.
It.
Well, I'm sure Amazon Prime can make it happen. I'm sure they can.
Copyright the name, mate.
But I think when you look at this image and then you look at the reality of it, the fact that they've, in the last year, signed Hummels, Emre Can, Thomas Meunier, add that to Axel Witsel, like the year before that. You don't buy these players to tread water. They're expensive, salary-wise, these guys. And they come to the club because they think they can win. So what can they realistically do? Because can they win the Bundesliga? It's going to be hard. It's going to need at least some partial implosion. They're going to need to do brilliantly and have some sort of buy-in implosion somewhere along the line. Can they win the Champions League? Well, they could, but are they likely to? You know, I think there's so much in the... Going back to what we said about Juventus, actually, there's so much about the manner rather than just the end result that I think is going to dictate where Dortmund are by the end of this season.
I think there's like a... To sort of bring back to what I was saying before about Juventus, I think there's something embedded in like clubs, and it's not fixed or permanent because clubs do change over time, but there's identities that clubs hold. And that's where I was sort of talking before about Inter and Milan, even when they weren't, and they haven't been so much lately, at the top of the game, they still carry that sort of big club identity to them. And I think perhaps Dortmund have had that, and maybe they still have it. And to be clear again, like, Dortmund were a better footballing team than Inter last season, as proved in the group stage. So it's not about the quality of the team. But I feel like the identity that Dortmund have right now is the place where all of the world's best young players should go and be brilliant for a little bit before heading on.
It's European football Hogwarts, is what you're saying.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. But I mean, it's genuinely brilliant. I'm not sort of saying that in a patronising way. They are really producing some of the best football in Europe through it. But there's still a certain deference in that. Now, Bellingham's move to Dortmund rather than Manchester United, who also wanted him, has been framed in lots of places as... because he knew that if he went to Dortmund, he would play and it would be brilliant. Mm. Whereas he went to Manchester United, who are a worse club, by the way, he, at least in the footballing terms at the moment, in my opinion,
yeah,
he would not play as much. So it's not about the quality of the football you're putting out, but it is still something... It's like there's almost like a sort of embedded idea there that we are not Munich. We're doing something different that is brilliant. But I just wonder if that limits them in some way. I don't know.
It's really important in terms of perception, that, I think, because funnily enough, the criticism of some of the match going fans has been we've become like a junior Bayern. You know, there is that sense, in the sense that they're trying to sell themselves pretty hard internationally, in a very different way to Bayern, but they are trying to sell themselves pretty hard internationally, and they have invested a lot of money in these cornerstone players. So on the other hand, it does make, as you say, Bellingham, Sancho, Haaland, and the image they project really, really important. But I agree with what you're saying.
Their identity is beneficial to them, in that it is the reason that Haaland goes there. It's the reason that Bellingham goes there. Like, it's not all negative. I just sort of wonder how it plays domestically with the sort of ability to challenge Bayern Munich in a structural way. In an individual season, I absolutely believe they can get ahead of Bayern Munich because, again, Leicester won the Premier League. This isn't something that just sort of happens in one place. That's not a Premier League specific story. Any team with the right combination of magic and the right players can do it. And Dortmund are structurally, again, set up to succeed more than Leicester are because the players they have are better. But I just sort of, I wonder... I don't know. I suppose, again, without wanting to keep bringing it back to Italy, and I'm sorry, like, I sort of see this possibility long-term mind, that Inter and Milan could be back on a level with Juventus at some point because they have that sort of stature about them.
Yes.
I don't know if I believe that can happen with Dortmund.
Have they started in Italy to bring fans back in the way that Germany has started to bring fans back? Because interesting sort of dynamic when you look at the games in Germany, which are regionally decided upon as to whether they can have fans in or not, depending on the COVID numbers, etc. You can see the difference, or feel the difference, certainly, from one match to another, because mm-hmm. they have a certain number of fans in, or less fans, or more fans in, or no fans at all. Have they started doing that in Italy?
Not yet. It's an ongoing conversation, but I believe until the end of September, it's still no fans. Of course, the season hasn't started yet, so it starts this weekend. But I don't. There has not been a clear statement on what happens past September yet. But there is certainly hope that it will happen soon, but it hasn't yet.
Because we've seen it in the cup matches in Germany so far. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what lessons we can learn about the way that they're manipulating. I know some of the stadiums don't have more than 20% fans.
Yeah, that's the maximum that's going to be allowed for 20%. This Bundesliga weekend. Yeah,
but it still made a huge difference. You know, it felt like the matches that I watched, just watching them online, it felt like football was back again with the fans.
And, it does.
And I you could feel the energy with the players as well. It was slightly different energy, I think.
It does. And I think the one you're angling towards, Dotton, is that Hansa Rostock Hamburg one where they had 10,000 in. The biggest crowd in Germany so far, that will be matched this weekend. Where Dortmund are going to have 10,000 in for their game against Borussia Mönchengladbach, which is like the Saturday night, which is like their gala game spot. That was particular because that's way out in the Wild East. That's also a third of the stadium capacity, which is not something that's going to be in any of the Bundesliga games this weekend. Now, I think it is a very positive thing. And I think the way they've framed it is very similar to what worked for them with the hygiene protocol when they brought the Bundesliga back in the first place. Like they've said, right, we're going to have limited attendances, 20% maximum over a 6-week trial period. And I think those words, over a 6-week trial period, are very important because you have the chief exec of the Bundesliga, Christian Seifert, who said, going back to before the Bundesliga restarted after the pandemic, he said, okay, well, this is the plan, but each match day, and I've said it before, and obviously it's quite a used quote, each match day, we're fighting to earn the next match day. And I think that's very important because I think in this particular environment, setting anything and assuming that it's all going to run to plan is a bit crazy, right?
There was no social distancing, by the way. Mm. A lot of people wore masks, which was great to see in a way. But I can imagine others looking on those games and thinking, well, hang on a second, they're not social distancing at the match. Why should we?
I think
that's going to be a problem.
I think that's why they've said it at 20%, Don. Because if you look at Hansa Rostock game that we were talking about, like I said, a third of the capacity, and it was quite a keenly contested game. You're right. I think the amount of fans that were in there and the atmosphere they created had a direct influence on the sort of match it was. And it sort of certainly had an influence on Tony Leisner, Hamburg debutant, climbing into the crowd and having a go at one of the fans at the end.
I wanted to ask about that and whether you think the fact specifically that there are less fans in the stadium means that players, in the same way that we've heard more, which players are making themselves heard, are you going to hear individual insults in a more personal way?
It's a great question. And I think that question might actually feed into what we're going to move into next.
Ortasını yapmadı, çekti Neymar. Topun altına girdi. Gol pozisyonu. Top alana gitti. Gol! Roberto! Cup Nuda!
So let's draw a line under the Bundesliga and let's turn our attentions to the French Ligue 1. You love the way I said it. Or should it be Une? Go on, you tell me it should be Une instead of
Un.
No, it's Un. I just wanted you to make a fool of yourself.
Trying to create a domestic.
I may have got an E, which was a fail, by the way. No, I think it was a D, actually, in French. But it doesn't mean that I don't know the difference between Un and Une. Now, the reason why I said that is because there was a match this week. 5,000 fans in the thing. And yet there was still an old-style kind of punch-up, really, that we haven't seen for quite a while.
Well, it is Paris Saint-Germain versus Marseille. It's something that we can't overlook.
Yeah, they're rivals, but so what? The kind of punch-up that we saw was like a punch-up over nothing, it seemed like.
It was next level. And I think, really, the thing that's really struck me about the opening of Liga, apart from the fact that I think the fans have made a difference, particularly you go back to the first game, even though there were only 5,000 there, that Paris Saint-Germain played this season on the Thursday before that when they lost at Lens. I think the thing that really struck me is that the fact that the refereeing has been terrible in this first week. It's been really awful. And whereas you can't strictly blame the referee for what the players did because it was pretty unsightly, and the bans have started to come down now. Levan Kozava, who attacked Jordan Amavi, you know, he threw a punch at him and then went and planted a flying kick on him. He's been banned for 6 matches. Amavi's been banned for 3. You've got Neymar out for 2, Paredes out for 2, Benedetto, who's the other player who sent off, just out for 1. Interestingly, Benedetto was the peacemaker. He was stopping Neymar going off. But what I was going to say is, while you wouldn't say that the referee made them do those things, he didn't deal with a lot of the issues that were boiling for the entire game much earlier. So to me, the most surprising thing was not the punch-up. How did Neymar last the whole 90 minutes before, without the referee either booking him or having a word with him, at the very least, to try and take some of the heat out of the situation? Why didn't maybe the PSG coaching staff step in? Because they've got eyes. They can see their star player absolutely on the brink of losing his shit for more than an hour for, it seems, very justifiable reasons, because he's having this dispute with Alvaro Gonzalez where there's a bit of back and forth. And Neymar obviously accused him twice of, well, made the accusation twice of Alvaro Gonzalez using racist language towards him, once in the first half. Again, the refereeing team didn't do anything about it. At the end, by the time he's off the pitch, the fourth official's thinking, it's all gone off, let's all sort it out afterwards. And he's already off anyway. How this pans out, I think, will be really, really interesting, because the French League have got a lot of eyes on them for this, and they should have a lot of eyes on them for this. Not just because it's Neymar, and because he's a world superstar, and because it's a world story. But I think if we rewind a little bit to when Mario Balotelli was at Nice, the subject of racial abuse from the stands, and the authorities did nothing about it. Absolutely nothing about it. And it caused the same thing with Balotelli. He protested to the referee. The referee booked him for gobbing off to him. And then you get this investigation, and we're in this similar stage now. There's going to be a deeper investigation into what Alvaro Gonzalez has allegedly said to Neymar. Now, the French League have commandeered all the footage, including a sort of solo cam that followed Neymar around the pitch from beIN Sports, who are one of the rights holders. So they're coming all the way through this. Now, Neymar, on the other hand, has been accused of making homophobic insults to Alvaro. So we're going to see how that pans out. Now, obviously, because there's this sort of lag between what actually happened and the investigation, it means a couple of things. Firstly, there's a load of time for everyone to talk about it. And yes, in Spain, El Confidencial did write a huge thing about Alvaro Gonzalez and how he's been through liking tweets from the leader of Vox, which I think is not insignificant. We can't pretend that's insignificant. But also, the pressure builds up on the league to deal with it. And having just really disgraced themselves in the way they didn't deal with Balotelli, they need to get this right. They have to get this right.
I'm sort of fascinated by this from a whole bunch of different angles, but it did, looking at just what we can see, and I think, you know, the context of what was said to Neymar is so fundamental to this, it's really hard to unpick. But looking at what we know, which is just the actions that happened, I was almost surprised that Neymar only got a 2-game ban, because if you're going to give Kozawa a 6-game ban, it seems almost like getting off lightly for that.
I think it's the degree of violence, because basically just
tapped him on the head.
It just clipped him around the back of the head. I mean, Kozawa looked... he looked like what he is, a fringe player who wants to prove how much it means to him, I thought. But, I mean, Neymar did say afterwards, he tweeted quite soon after the game, didn't he? The only regret I have is not hitting that idiot in the face. And I think it's what a lot of people think in moments like that. If I was going to get sent off, I might as well get full value for it.
We're not talking about the football, though. Nobody's talked about the football. Nobody's talking about the football.
You know, we've not even mentioned that Angel Di Maria is also under investigation in this, of all times, for spitting at Alvaro Gonzalez.
Oh, no.
As well.
Di Maria.
Yeah. Seeing he's the only player who looks like creating anything for them. I mean, as we speak, they've just got their first win of the season. They beat Metz 1-0 last night for a goal from Julian Draxler, who they've been doing everything to shift and sell in stoppage time, created by Angel Di Maria, who looks like the only player who's making anything happen at the moment. So they've got almost to the end of their first three league games without scoring a goal. They got into stoppage time of the third league game without scoring a goal. And even bearing in mind the COVID absences that we've talked about, everything else, that's remarkable.
Which of those two teams do you feel, Nicky, will suffer the most from the bans and everything else from this punch-up?
I think in the short term, PSG suffer, because I think that this team that just went to a Champions League final, to me, is still fundamentally just massively reliant on two players. I think that it shouldn't be, but I think that the difference in what PSG produce when Neymar and Mbappe are on the pitch together specifically to when they're not is night and day. And I think that you take any of that away and they lose something really big.
They do. I think the other interesting thing is talking about how the coaches can look ahead and spy trouble. I think it's quite interesting that Andre Villas-Boas took off his most two important players who they rely on, Payet and Tovar, who are both, let's not beat around the bush, prolific baiters of Paris Saint-Germain. and he took them off earlier on, sensible.
But at the same time as saying that, it is only for Neymar a couple of games. Do I think that this season doesn't still end with PSG in first place? No, I don't think that.
Look, there's more to be said about this punch-up, and we'll get to that when it comes back and revisits us. But for now, let's bring this to a conclusion. We've asked you both to suggest a game of the week of your own choice that we should all be watching. Who wants to go first?
I mean, mine's super obvious because we've spent half of this podcast talking about him, but it's Pirlo's first game. It's Pirlo's first game as manager. He is literally on Monday of this week, he was at Coverciano at the Scuola Allenatori, the manager's school for Italian managers, defending his thesis so he could get his UEFA Pro license. He's just done that. He's managed a friendly against Novara, which they won 5-0, but 11 substitutions. So it's not a game you're going to get a lot from. His first game is this weekend. It's against Sampdoria, coached by someone at the other end of the spectrum, Claudio Ranieri, who's been around forever and has coached every team in Italy, it feels like, sometimes. So I think, look, competitively, with a new manager or not, that's a game Juventus should expect to win pretty easily. Sampdoria are not awful, but they are very much a middle-of-the-road, top-flight team at the moment, with reliance on a really, as much as he's defied age, a not young Fabio Quagliarella up front. I think it'll be fascinating to see how that goes. I expect Juventus to win, but I want to see how they win and how they play.
And that's Sunday night, right?
Yes.
Right.
And Andy?
In that case, I'm going to go for something from the other end of the weekend. I'm going to go for Friday night, Famalicão versus Benfica. Now, we touched on the ramble on Benfica's really dreadful failure to not qualify for the Champions League after spending 82 million euros on transfer fees alone on players. Forget about the salaries and all that sort of stuff. To have in the Champions League qualifier against PAOK, to have Vertonghen score an own goal, one of those signings, and then Andrej Zivkovic, a player who they paid to leave just over a week ago, come and score the winner against them. And Jorge Jesus, after the first match of his second spell, is under the cosh already. It's changed the way they look at things. Instead of like buying in a few of his favourites from Flamengo, which they're still aiming to do, they might have to sell a player now. Like the immediate money that they get up front for qualifying for the Europa League is about an eighth of what they would have got from the Champions League. So this is something that has a massive effect on them this season. They built a squad to challenge in the Champions League. So there's a lot of pressure on straight away. Also, because of the timing of it, as we said, it's on Friday night. You can get it on the LiveScore app. You can watch it for free. But they got the league to position this on Friday night because they thought, well, when we knock off PAOK, we'll be playing Krasnodar next week. It's a long trip to Russia. We need a few extra days off. But in fact, they're not going there. And they've brought the game forward, so they've got relatively little rest time. And Famalicão, having been promoted last season, okay, they've lost a few players, but it's a tough place to go. Porto lost there in the title running at the end of the resume season. So it's not going to be easy for them. We're going to see Jorge Jesus, like, I think, anguishly putting his hands through that lustrous hair a bit more.
Well, we came for the football, but thank you, Andy. And thank you to Nicky Bandini of The Guardian and Andy Brassel, sometime of The Guardian as well. That's it for this edition of On the Continent.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances?
Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.